This is the Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. It is our great pleasure to be with Paul Hawken after many years of trying. It happens that this morning we did a program with a biographer of Ralph Waldo Ellison. And much of what we learned in thinking about Ellison, who wrote The Invisible Man, and is really a very pivotal person in the intellectual history of our time, went straight back to his namesake, Ralph Waldo Emerson. And I was quite taken aback how regularly you, in thinking about where we are, how we've gotten here, who we can be, went to the ideas that one of my favorite books of all time, Emerson, The Mind on Fire. The things that Emerson offered us in 1836 are so current and so powerful and so now that it was quite striking that you just couldn't go very far in Blessed Unrest, but would you bump enough against Waldo?
Well, when I was researching it and I realized the scale, not that I know the exact scale, but that it was the largest movement in the world, albeit unnamed, then the question is, well, where did it come from? And the popular theory on the environmental side would say, well, post-Rachel Carson, which isn't true, although she deserves enormous credit for what she did and what she engendered. And on the social justice side, it goes back to the Code of Hammurabi in, you know, Babylon. So, I mean, you can't really open that bag up without really following it way back into history. But on the environment and social justice side, it really does lead to Emerson in this country. And I was surprised, actually, because I think when we are asked to read Emerson in high school, it's kind of a pain, and I think we don't really have the life experience to understand. We can read the language, but we can't understand the thoughts as well.
And as you say, in Calvinist America, they only give us a piece of it.
They really give us the stuff on prudence, but they don't give us the stuff that's elegiac and basically out there. And I read Mind on Fire. I read Richardson's work on Thoreau as well, and many other works about Emerson and that time. And I was quite stunned to note a particular occurrence that happened in Paris in 1833. After his wife had died in 1832, he went to take the tour, you know, the waters, I guess, whatever, to go to Europe, and Coleridge and Wordsworth and other of his colleagues were there to greet him. But he started in Malta, went up the route of Italy, ended up in Paris in July in 1833, and went to the Jardin des Plantes, which is a botanical garden created by the Jussot family, Bernard and Antoine Laurent. And it was a famous family of botanists and taxonomists and who created systematics. They were later employed by Wallace and Darwin. But in the cabinet, if you will, of natural history, they had displayed flora and fauna in these arrays of color and morphology and form that clearly one, in this case Emerson, could see the web of life. And of course he'd already been fascinated with nature in a kind of romantic way, but for the first time he could actually see the connection. And that night in his journal, it seems like the first time he's elated, that he has a joyous experience since his wife has died. And these are epiphanic entries into the journal about seeing the web of life. He doesn't use that term, but he sees how everything is connected, that it is all nature, and that our mind itself is nature. And therefore, what is the nature of the mind, and what is the nature of governance, and what is the nature of religion, of justice? And he has found his niche, he's found his vein, he's found this enormous wellspring of thinking and ideas that basically took him out of being the Unitarian minister, you know, in the Old South Church, and now he is a completely different person. And he comes back to America, and his first book is, of course, Nature, and one of the first people to buy it and read it is Harvard's first hippie, which is Henry David Thoreau.
And then, as they say, the rest becomes history.
Well, it's so interesting because the history gets even more complex, because after he addresses a senior class, Thoreau goes to Emerson's house in Cambridge, and you know, he's been to Harvard for 4 years and studied the classics and basically is unemployable. And
this is so great.
Asks Emerson, what should I do? And Emerson says, keep a journal. And he does from that day on for 7,000 pages. It's such an incredible moment, you know, of advice.
Yes.
And it was really, you know, 12 years later when he was arrested by Sam Staples, Thoreau, walking in from Walden for not paying his poll tax, which he didn't pay because he was protesting the fact that Polk was elected, knowing he would go to war with Mexico, and felt this was just an egregious violation of the Mexican people, of the American people, of the doctrine of war. When he was arrested, there's an apocryphal story of Emerson coming to jail and saying, Henry, what are you doing in there? And Thoreau saying, Waldo, what are you doing out there? It didn't.
I don't care if it's apocryphal, it's still a great story.
Well, the reason it's a great story is because it actually delineates, if you will, the difference between the student and the teacher. And as we know, as students, we take our teachers at their word. And Thoreau took his teacher at his word, which is everything is connected. From Emerson's point of view, Thoreau had done something that stigmatized his reputation, therefore it was something that was, you know, you didn't do in polite society. From Thoreau's point of view, as he said in his later essay, if the government is unjust, the just man is in jail, and therefore if the Texas Rangers are raping Mexican women, then if I pay my tax for it, I am a rapist. And that is so interesting to me, not just because of the relationship, because here now Thoreau, who is a great scientist and naturalist, really superb, if he'd only done that, he would be in the academy. But here in his essay, then called Resistance to Civil Government, he creates a whole branch of social justice.
And it is now called?
Civil disobedience.
And of course, that then rolls like the thunder across the ages.
It does.
And don't you find that in this million or 2 million or 3 million organizations, don't you see little sparks off of that log?
I don't think there's anywhere where the sort of the meme of civil disobedience doesn't exist and hasn't permeated this movement.
That's a big change.
One of the challenges is our deep denial of reality.
Well, there's that.
And I say that in the context of talking about the Mexican War. In our history, you know, in the history I grew up with, it was a blip. It was, you know, remember the Alamo, kill a lot of Mexicans, live happily ever after.
Oh, and do take Texas with you.
Well, Texas and Arizona.
And California.
And New Mexico. And Arizona. And Colorado.
So that you can have California.
which is, you know, the great chauvinist perspective. We are still paying the price for this. Today we are arguing, you know, we're one another's throats. Americans are one another's throat about immigration, which focuses principally on the Mexican border.
Yeah.
So it's not as if Thoreau was just being obdurate or a radical. These things have real world consequences, and they're real world consequences that endure. They don't just go away. So that these behaviors, these national behaviors and these individual behaviors, are critical to who and what we are as a species.
And everything matters. Isn't that part of what this book is about, that everything everybody does matters?
Absolutely. In fact, one of the takeaways of that story about Emerson and Thoreau, because it keeps going, is that we tend to focus, in hindsight, on events in history that we then determine are the turning points. And then, in so doing, we look ahead and look for the turning point, the charismatic leader, philosopher, religious person. But in fact, when we really parse history very carefully, what we find is that many, many, many seemingly tiny, inconsequential acts change history.
This is back to biology.
Absolutely.
This is one tiny piece of DNA changes the whole organism.
Well, look at civil disobedience itself. Thoreau never used the term. It's not in any of his writings. It's not in any of the writings he read at that time. No one knows who named the essay Civil Disobedience because it was named 4 years after he died. And it is such a powerful meme, that phrase itself, and it had such huge importance for a young solicitor in South Africa named Mohandas K. Gandhi, because he had presided over a meeting of Muslims and Hindus who were outraged at the Asiatic Registration Act that had been passed, the Black Act, that required apartheid, that required them to carry around these cards and show them it passes.
And this is Indians from some kind of India in South Africa.
1906. And he presided over a meeting which 1,100 of his countrymen voted to get arrested rather than register. And as a solicitor, he wrote in his journal that night how concerned he was about what they had agreed to and what were the implications, which he realized he hadn't thought through. And it was shortly thereafter when somebody who we don't know gave him a copy of Civil Disobedience, and somebody from the Indian Times gave it to him. And it was a revelation, because what Thoreau did was make going to jail cool. That it was not a stigma, it was a badge of honor.
And Paul Hawken tells this along with many important stories in Blessed Unrest. Come back for more stories when we return in a moment with Paul Hawken.